Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A new market opens up and companies want at it. Not quite that easy when you're talking about Iran. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, November 25th. Thanks, as always, for joining us. We begin today with Iran and how you might respond to the potentially landmark agreement between Iran and Western powers if you're a business. Remember, some sanctions are being eased in return for Iran's freezing of parts of its nuclear program for 6 months. And after that, the Obama administration and its allies hope this short-term agreement could pave the way for a longer-term deal. But in the business world, 6 months is kind of, a blip on the calendar. Marketplace's David Gura starts us off with a look at how companies are thinking about this.
Okay, maybe a few U.S. executives dusted off old business development plans for Iran this morning.
It's a populous country. It's a highly educated country, and there are a lot of opportunities.
Morris DeFeo is a lawyer, the head of the Middle East and North Africa practice at Crowell & Mooring. That said,
you know, with any new market, there comes risks. But, I mean, this is a pretty risky situation, I think, for most companies.
DeFeo says no deal, no matter how comprehensive, can fix the broken relationship between the U.S. and Iran overnight.
I think a lot of people are going to sit back and see if these sanctions and this accord will be something more than interim.
That's because that's all they can do. While this deal lifts some sanctions, most companies still won't be allowed to do business with Iran, a country with 76 million people and a GDP of about $500 billion. Nader Habibi is a professor of the economics of the Middle East at Brandeis.
Once the sanctions are removed, there would be, I think, many opportunities for American international oil companies.
Iran's oil industry depended on U.S. technology for decades. Javad Salehi Isfahani is a visiting scholar at Harvard's Belfer Center. He says this short-term agreement does open the door right away to companies in pharmaceuticals and aerospace.
Iran does have a fleet of Boeing airplanes, very old and aging, that need a lot of repair.
And Salehi Isfahani says sanctions have forced Iranians to buy generic drugs made in India and other countries.
And when you talk to them, they're always complaining that this is not as good as the drugs that we used to buy.
Over the last 2 years, sanctions have become much more severe. They've pushed out European companies. But the U.S. was the first Western country to break trade relations with Iran.
They have been excluded from the Iranian market for much longer than European and East Asian firms.
Which means it would take a lot longer for them to get back in. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We've got a big name adding a Yahoo and an exclamation point to her email address today. Katie Couric is leaving ABC News to become Yahoo's global anchor. Yahoo has been on a hiring spree lately, and Couric is its highest profile get. Yahoo also gets something else from this, another chance to widen its reach beyond being just an internet company. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports.
Yahoo will get more than Katie Couric and the other top journalists it's hired. It'll get all the people Katie Couric can interview.
What has been the most surprising thing for you about being First Lady? Yes.
How old were you, Justin, when you posted this?
I was like 12.
But really, Yahoo is hoping to get something else.
Yahoo is trying to solve a fundamental problem, which is, what is Yahoo?
Marty Kaplan is a professor at USC's Annenberg School.
Is it an email address? Is it a news site? Is it just always on the top of the list of most used sites, but no one knows why? They're looking for a brand identity.
Specifically, Yahoo wants to be synonymous with original content. That's why it spent so much money on recent hires like the New York Times, David Pogue, Matt Bai, and Megan Lieberman. Entertainment analyst Robert Galinsky says it's trying to edge out traditional news, especially TV news.
The old world news system on television is going away. Yahoo is going to start to take some of that TV news market.
At least that's the idea. But really, as with most things, it's about money. In July, Yahoo overtook Google as the most visited website on the internet, though many analysts are at a loss to explain why. Still, revenue from display ads, that's like banners on websites, was down 7% last quarter. Ken Doctor is a media analyst for Newsonomics.
The ad competition is just brutal.
One way to make more money from ads? Sell video ads. Ken Doctor says they're worth a lot more.
Video advertising is selling out. You can still sell those at rates that are 6 to 8 times higher than what you're getting on display advertising.
That is, of course, if people watch. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of a flat Monday all around. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Nearly 500,000 people have put their spit into a little tube in the last 6 years and sent that tube to a company called 23andMe. The company then genetically analyzes that saliva. The results are supposed to show customers how susceptible they are to more than 250 diseases. But the FDA now says the company hasn't proved the tests are accurate enough. And the agency is worried Americans are relying on the results instead of going to the doctor. Dove Fox specializes in medical ethics at the University of San Diego School of Law. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why are people looking at 23andMe so closely? Why is it causing such a flurry of headlines?
This field of personalized medicine is really in its infancy, and it's terrifically exciting what we might learn one day, but it's just not there yet. Now, 23andMe and the FDA's determination that their direct-to-consumer genetic testing is indeed a device hasn't shown that the reports about your health from your genes alone are all that useful. They're just not accurate at this time in the way that the FDA has required.
The flip side, of course, is that, gee, it's great to be able to get information about my own health for a pretty reasonable price point, without having to go to a doctor, pay a ton of money, and have a bunch of regulators standing in the way.
That is, of course, the argument that 23andMe, other companies like them make, and it's a powerful one. The problem is that our understanding of genetics, especially in the public, is very low, and that these tests come not only with limited accuracy, but also without the benefit of genetic counseling. So imagine that you send your DNA away, you receive news back from 23andMe, this is the kind of information that they do provide, that you're negative for the BRCA1 and BRCA2, those mutations that lead somebody to be more susceptible to getting certain forms of breast cancer. Well, armed with that information, the individual might decide to avoid getting mammograms. Well, that decision could be fatal. So not having those particular mutations, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 in this case, lowers your genetic risk from about 12.5% to 12.4% of getting breast cancer. And so it's clearly a mistake to avoid mammograms, but the information you receive back from a company like 23andMe doesn't tell you any of this.
When you think about what the marketplace for genetic testing is going to look like in, say, a decade, how important is the role of federal regulators in increasing, decreasing the size of that marketplace?
You know, the ways in which the FDA has asserted today its interest in regulating these techniques will have implications not just for genetic testing of individuals, but I think for prospective children as well.
Dove Fox is an assistant professor of law at the University of San Diego School of Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
More than 5 years out now from the government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Their fates are still undecided. Washington is trying to figure out whether and how much the government should be in the housing market. One issue is the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. A lot of people in the U.S. have one, but it's a pretty uncommon loan if you look at other housing markets around the world. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has our story of the loan a lot of us take for granted. It was the 1920s. A man wants a house, walks into a local bank.
I'd like to buy a house in Waukegan, Illinois.
Waukegan, Illinois? Prime real estate, that.
But I'm gonna need a loan.
A loan, you say? Well, I can give you these terms. How about 50% down and 5 years to pay off what you owe?
Well, give me a pen, because I've got signing on the brain.
And I have a dotted line.
And sign he did. But then, the Great Depression. Our Waukegan homeowner's loan came due, and his lender wasn't in a lending mood.
If you don't have the money, we'll have to foreclose.
Okay, enough newsreel. Our old-timey borrower, like a lot of people, had a 5-year balloon mortgage. He and a 250,000 other folks lost their home each year between 1931 and 1935. President Franklin D. Roosevelt stepped in, explaining why the government couldn't just sit by.
Even before I was inaugurated, I came to the conclusion that such a policy was too much to ask the American people to bear. It involved not only a further loss of homes and farms and savings and wages, but also a loss of spiritual value, the loss of that sense of security for the present and the future that is so necessary to the peace and contentment of the individual and of his family.
To stabilize the economy, he created federal agencies that form the basis of the housing market we have today. They provided mortgage insurance, established a secondary market, and converted 1 million loans into long-term mortgages. Professor Susan Wachter from the Wharton School says the changes were really transformational.
It made housing affordable, and it made housing home ownership sustainable.
More people could afford to buy and keep a home. Home costs were disconnected from the business cycle. Mortgages became safer, stable.
The loan will not come due until, in fact, you've paid it off, which makes it affordable. When you stretch out the payments, they become affordable.
In the 1940s, the maximum length of the mortgage was extended to 30 years, making home ownership even more affordable and stimulating the housing market. Now, fast forward to today, Roosevelt's economic fix is still with us. It's the norm. The first half of this year, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage accounted for nearly 90% of new mortgages. Robert Bridges is an economics professor at USC.
It's protected species. I mean, it's just absolutely something that that stands out as a great thing if you can get it.
Great for the borrower, that is. Bridges says the 30-year fixed rate mortgage has all sorts of protections for one side.
The one-sidedness comes, number one, from locking that interest rate in over an outrageously long period of time.
By locking in the rate, borrowers are protected if interest rates go up. And there's no refinance penalty, so they're protected if interest rates go down.
It doesn't make it a real attractive investment for banks any longer. And that's by and large the reason that we have the public so heavily involved in underwriting and backstopping residential mortgages.
If the government ever decides to get out of the business of backstopping mortgages, to privatize the mortgage market, some economists think the 30-year fixed-rate loan we take for granted could become a whole lot more expensive or even disappear. The long-term mortgage is a bet a lot of lenders don't want to take on their own. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Adrian takes a look at our love affair with a 30-year mortgage. Coming up, when you create a job in a place like Rwanda,
those family networks and communal networks are so tight, you are supporting an entire community.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended just 7 points higher, less than 0.1%, at 16,072. The NASDAQ nudged up 2 points, about 0.1%, to end the day at 39.94, while the S&P 500 eased down 2 points, just over 0.1%, to close at 18.02. Alcoa jumped more than 3.5% after Goldman Sachs upgraded shares of the aluminum producer to buy from neutral. Caterpillar crept up 1.8% after Bank of America gave the company shares an upgrade. Boeing tilted downwards, falling 2.1% after the airline manufacturer warned of engine icing risk on its new 747-8 and 787 Dreamliner planes. Tech had a mixed day. Google rose 1.4%, and Apple polished up 0.2%. But Facebook thumbed down 3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for September and October. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And Peanuts creator Charles Schulz was born on November 26, 1922. Just a friendly reminder to set your DVR on Thursday for a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. It's been around since 1973. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in all week for Kai Rizdahl. The Affordable Care Act financed a big group of healthcare navigators to help ordinary people figure out how to get the best insurance policy under the new system. Meanwhile, there's a large group of people who've had that job for, well, ever. They're health insurance brokers. They've continued to do that job, or try to, as Obamacare has rolled out. Marketplace's Dan Weissman asked a few of them, how's it going?
Each broker's got his own metaphor. Here's one from Craig Gustin in San Diego.
I guess the best way to put it, imagine if you're a CPA and that the government announced that everybody can get their taxes done for free.
He doesn't mean he's working for free, just that he's that busy. People see him as a conduit to deep discounts on their health insurance. California's running its own exchange. It's going a lot smoother than the one at healthcare.gov. So Gustin says once people are done waiting to see him, he's able to help them. They get insurance and a subsidy if they qualify. In other states, agents tell a different story. Mark Gerda serves customers in 20 states. His business is up, but that's where the good news ends. Here's his metaphor.
Imagine if you were a pharmaceutical company who made an antidote for a serious virus. And as a result of a weaponized virus, your business went way up. You would not be really happy about the reasons that your business went up.
He says he's concerned that many of his customers will end up worse off. In large part, he blames the problems with healthcare.gov and the politics surrounding the Affordable Care Act. Finally, Mark Brown runs an agency in a Chicago suburb. Here's his metaphor.
Health insurance used to be like playing chess on a three-dimensional board in Spanish. Okay? It's now like playing chess on a six-dimensional board in multi-languages.
That is, so difficult, he had a hard time finding affordable coverage for himself and his employees. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
If you haven't started shopping for Thanksgiving dinner yet, you are in luck. That big ticket item on the table, the turkey, is going to cost even less than usual. Shannon Mullen explains why.
The average price for Thanksgiving dinner this year is $49.04, including all the trimmings. That feeds 10 people, says the American Farm Bureau Federation on its annual survey. A 16-pound turkey is the priciest item on the menu at $21.76. Turns out that's a price drop.
Actually down 47 cents from a year ago.
Federation economist John Anderson says one reason for the change, some retailers discount turkey to sell it as a loss leader.
Turkey is going to be the thing that most people are going to want to have as the centerpiece of their meal. And so if, as a retailer, you can get people in your store to buy the turkey, it's unlikely that that's all they're going to buy, right?
At this Market Basket location in the Boston area, store brand turkeys are on sale for 59 cents a pound. That's about 77 cents below average. There's a long freezer case full of them, flanked by bins of stuffing and everything else holiday shoppers might have on their lists.
Poultry seasoning, gravy. Definitely got our gravy displayed. We got our cranberry sauce.
Rob Harrington is a manager at the store. He says business doubles this time of year.
We know what sells. We know what people want during a particular season, so that's what we put out.
Kind of like Black Friday specials at department stores. Besides the retail markdown, wholesale turkey prices drop in the fourth quarter every year, says Corrine Alexander, professor of agricultural economics at Purdue.
Partly because the entire turkey industry gears up for delivering those supplies of turkey at Thanksgiving, and so they go into that fourth quarter with large supplies in cold storage.
This year, producers have about 4% more turkey on ice than last year, and since it's a commodity,
the price that they receive from consumers only goes up when the supply of what they're producing comes down.
So for now, the bird is a bargain, but that cancels out if you like pumpkin pie. This year's survey says most of the ingredients to make it will cost a bit more. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace. This week, Thanksgiving dinner will be served at a restaurant overlooking Kigali, Rwanda, called Heaven. It's owned by Josh and Alyssa Ruxin. They moved to Rwanda from New York in 2006 to do health and development work in a country still recovering from genocide. They've stayed, opened the restaurant, and are raising three young kids. Josh Ruxin wrote about the restaurant and his family's work in the new book, A Thousand Hills to Heaven. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You had worked in international development, and really you'd been interested in this stuff since high school. Did you ever think you'd be running a restaurant?
It never really crossed my mind. I mean, I always love great food and I love great service, but I never thought that we would end up starting a restaurant together.
So how did it happen?
Well, Alyssa was working with a group of students and very quickly identified that in addition to what problems they might have at home, living with orphans, living with others who didn't have jobs, for example, that the very greatest challenge for them was they weren't making a living. And so Alyssa proposed to me, hey, why don't I start a little cafe, which sounded really seductive, actually. Some plastic chairs, some tables, some delicious Rwandan coffee. That should be a really low bar to get over. And soon after, she identified a beautiful piece of land overlooking Kigali, a very large, brand new chain that actually is here in New York and also in Washington and Boston called Bourbon Cafe opened up. And she said, we've got to change plans. We're going to open up a gourmet restaurant.
There's a lot of culture clashing that goes on in this book.
Absolutely. And most of our staff had never set foot in a restaurant. Most of our cooks had never really cooked in a restaurant that we would consider as serving great food. And so translating that into the local language and into local habits was challenging every single day. And it's still a challenge today because we're always striving to be the very best restaurant, not just in Rwanda, not just in East Africa, but one of the best places to go eat in the world.
When you look at the traditional mode through which aid from North America and from Europe has come to Africa, do you consider it effective?
I think dollar for dollar, no. At the same time, I've seen a lot of good aid. So, for example, there's no wait list in Rwanda to receive antiretroviral drugs for HIV/AIDS. But one of my biggest critiques of aid is, why isn't it helping to start up small and medium-sized enterprises? Why isn't it providing financing to start up places like Heaven Restaurant? It's one thing when in the States or Europe, you create one job. You're going to impact that person and certainly that person's family. But when you create a job in a place like Rwanda, you are impacting dozens of people because those family networks and communal networks are so tight, you are supporting an entire community. So when we count up the dozens who are on our monthly payroll and all the farmers who are bringing in the food that we serve at Heaven, we calculate that Heaven is actually impacting thousands and thousands of people. And It's not aid. It's a business.
How do you make clear that this is a place you love and avoid what I think some people who set out to do good in the world carry with them as sort of a white savior industrial complex?
Well, certainly that's something that I try to address in the book, but I think that we have sort of reduced our efforts down to a couple pretty simple rules. And one of them is that we're there now as private investors who are out to create jobs and increase service levels. And it just so happens that that is the very best way to reduce poverty.
Josh Ruxin is the author of 1,000 Hills to Heaven. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
For this final note today, so you know how turkey makes you sleepy because of all that tryptophan? Well, it turns out that's not true. I saw it on the internet.
It turns out that cheese and pork actually have more tryptophan in them than turkey does. But no one ever claims that the ham and cheese sandwich made them sleepy. No, it's always the turkey.
Oh, yeah. That's a guy named Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's a professor of pediatrics at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He goes on. You might be sleepy from the big meal or wine or because you're tired from a family argument. But stop blaming the turkey, okay? It's not the turkey's fault. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ended just 7 points higher, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ nudged up 2 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 eased down 2 points, just over 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.